So, I have for you these two articles to look at, you know, at any time. There's no super time rush. You're not going to get tested over them or anything like that. But this is good for your own edification. So, again, this is just basically applying general relativity to condensed matter physics problems or physics in other areas. And from time to time, if I see anything else interesting this semester, I'll kind of print it out and get it to you guys. You could do what you can with it. Now, also, last time when I was going over the syllabus, I mentioned, you know, there's other textbooks and things you could use to help you study for the class. And I brought a few examples here. The first one, and this is kind of the best book on general relativity I think has been written, is this Gravitation by Messner, Thorne, and Wheeler, also known as MTW. And so this one, obviously huge book. It is about just shy of 1,300 pages long. So it goes through everything, and it goes through it in a lot more detail than you're going to find in Carroll's book. So if there's something that's unclear, or if there's you read something in Carroll's book and he doesn't seem to go into enough information for you, you want to learn more about, then this is a very good source. And it's also, it's very well written. And, you know, the funny thing is I met Kip Thorne, and I met Messner, and I was thinking, well, you know, reading some of Kip Thorne's stuff, I thought that he was the one that was really the long writer out of the group. It turns out it's Wheeler. So, and Wheeler, by the way, he's the guy who was Kip Thorne's advisor. He was Richard Feynman's advisor. Yeah. Very, very distinguished. There was an article about him in Physics Today a few months ago. Another resource is, these are Sean Carroll's notes I mentioned, and this is just my bound version that I use from graduate school. And essentially, it's the same thing as the space-time book, just an older version of it. If you're really, really cheap, you can almost just go through and read this and then just have to figure out a way to get the problems. But it's got everything but the problems from Sean Carroll's book. If you go to the website, he's actually got a website listed inside his book.
Space, Time, and Geometry.
Yeah. And if you go to that website, you'll see something like this. And there's basically, there is a bunch of different things he has in here. He has the lecture notes on it. He has all the errors that are in the book as people track them. Anything like that you can use. He has this thing, a no-nonsense introduction to general relativity, which is a very, you know, it's almost amazing. You go from MTW to this, which is literally, I want to say it's like 23 pages long. And so it's a 23-page version of the book, which goes through, you know, most of the same stuff, just very, very briefly. And then this is also something you can find. I think you could find this on the OpenCourseWare site at MIT. Lecture Notes on General Relativity and Gravitational Radiation by Maurice Van Putten. And, you know, this version of it, I had issues with the printing, as you could see. But as an example, this is just one of the chapters on electrodynamics. And it does a very good job of talking about P forms and dualities and geometric representations of the electromagnetic field tensor, rank of ideal MHD. So this is like all of the stuff that some of the more mathematical stuff that you might lose yourself in, this is just a different perspective on that can help you. There was another one, Linear Algebra in a Nutshell. I downloaded this a while back. And if you look at this, it basically goes through, and you see this glossary in here of things like defining a determinant, defining covariant vectors, things like that. And so that was just a very useful resource. Another thing I found, and this is some time ago, was I taught a short summer class on group theory. And there was this, a couple things I found in here. One, Elementary Introduction to Groups and Representations by Brian Hall. And then the other one was Group Theory, J.S. Moline. And I think both of these are actually in the physics archives. At least the first one is. And you can actually download it and print it out, and it's just whatever the cost of the printing is.
Physics archives where?
If you go... The physics archives, this is something you should know about, especially if you, you're going to do physics research. Basically, physics has a tradition of preprints, which you don't find in a lot of other fields. And that, you know, other people think physicists are weird because they publish stuff before they publish it. And so archive is basically you have a paper, you could put it out for people to read it before it's been peer reviewed. And sometimes you can just literally take that archive and upload it to the journal, and they'll peer review it from there. And the URL for it, http://www.archive.org. A-R-K-I-V. Archive. And then when you get within the archive, you can see basically they are broken up into categories like GRQC is basically general relativity and quantum gravity or quantum cosmology, and there'll be condensed matter physics, high energy physics, etc. And you can also, there's a mirror site for all the archive. At Los Alamos, xxx.losalamosnationallab.gov. And that's something where, you know, you could tell that these are some of the oldest websites out there. I mean, they, you know, they were the World Wide Web before there was a World Wide Web. Yeah. And so they've basically been posting stuff like that for a while. And you could see archives were basically...
Carol's lecture notes are on Los Alamos.
Yeah. Yeah, Carol's lecture notes are in there, too. And you can basically... I'd say something like 80%, 80 to 90% of the physics articles you find that have been written in the past 10 years or so, you'll find them on the archive. And the articles on here, I think the oldest ones on there go back to the early 90s. So you might even, you know, so you can find some quite a bit. If you're looking for an article that was written in like 1967 before there was like a World Wide Web, then don't bother. But I found that like a lot of articles, anytime I need to find an article, it's like it was a preprint before it was an actual article, and it's right on there. And you can actually look at the published article and you look at the preprint, and there's not like a sentence difference between them a lot of the time. The one thing you do have to be careful about is that these are not peer-reviewed. So sometimes if you find an article in there, you might want to check to see if it's been published through peer review.
And if it hasn't, there's probably a reason.
Yeah. I mean, it might be they abandoned it and they decided not to go further with it, or it might be that, you know, there was some other issue where it just didn't make it. The other stuff I recommend, of course, there's the Sean Carroll book. But then this is a book. I actually bought a copy of this at MIT years ago, right when I started graduate school. And this, Introduction to Space-Time by Laurent, I think this is one of the best-written books on special relativity. And it was seemed like it was going to go out of print and become unavailable, like all the good books do. But I think they ended up basically just repackaging and sending it out again. But excellent book for like a very good conceptual understanding of special relativity. This is also another good book, Relativistic Numerical Hydrodynamics. I use this quite a bit in my research, and the idea of it is that it actually tells you how some of the fluids stuff works. We're going to talk about relativistic fluids. And that's something that might be, you're not going to really use it now, but maybe towards the end of the semester when we start talking about cosmology, there's some things that might be pretty relevant in there. And if you ever want to do any physics research involving relativity, then the fluid stuff is very important. Also, speaking of computational, this is a book, this is brand new, Numerical Relativity, which basically is solving Einstein's equations on a computer. And this is written by Thomas Baumgard and Stu Shapiro, who are pretty much the biggest people in numerical relativity, so they're the highest authorities you're going to find. And so I got that book, I think... I got a desk copy of it at the beginning of December. I was done with it before New Year's and just went through and just read the whole thing. And it's good because it's basically everything I had to learn through grad school the hard way is in there. And, you know, you can just read through it, and it's how to do different things and how to do create numerical models of this stuff in general relativity. Everything you need to know. And there's also another book Alcubierre wrote on numerical relativity. I don't think it's as good, but, I mean, it's kind of hard to top that one. That one's the first really good, comprehensive book I think anybody's ever written on the subject. So these are just some other things for you guys to read to learn a little bit more. And let's see. Denson already emailed me, said he's not making it. Did Carolyn say anything to anybody about?
I thought she was supposed to be here.
Okay. All right. Well, she may just have to listen to recording. So anyway, let's just get started on today's lecture. And because she comes in late, she'll just have to catch up. So what we're going to be talking about today is essentially going through sections 1.6 through 1.9 in Carroll's book. And a lot of this is still what I consider the review section, although some of the stuff is going to be, somewhat challenging. So the idea here is we're going to continue on about tensors. And a tensor, as you know, is basically a generalization of vectors or scalars or dual vectors or whatever. And one idea is a tensor can be thought of as something that maps multiple vectors and or duals to some real number. Okay, now what does that mean? You're going to hear this term maps a lot in this, especially in the introductory part. And if you go through and you read this stuff on group theory, or or you go back and you read about tensors in Matthews and Walker, or Arfkin and Weber, then that's going to be, which are a couple more books. I didn't feel like there was any need to bring them since you guys should all have copies of those. Not anymore?
I couldn't care anymore.
Okay. So, I made Tom help me carry the books down. And he has some questions after class, so he has to help carry them up, too. So anyway, you're gonna hear this term maps a lot. And basically what maps are, in a general sense, is if you can imagine a map, then you have like a globe or a representation of where you are. And then you kind of created this flat map that describes exactly where you are and what you're what's going on. And so the map isn't the actual world, or it is actually a representation. It's just a representation of what's real. And so what's happening here is you can take something like these. As you remember, these are like vector bundles, which represent a set of all vectors at a particular point. In this case, they're duals because they have the star on them. And these are getting mapped to a real number. And we know that we can take the scalar product of a vector and a dual and get a real number. But what tensors do is they're basically saying if you have multiple vectors, it's going to map these multiple vectors into a real number. And they're going to be linear in all arguments. So if you take this tensor, T, and you make it a function of these duals and these vectors, then you can write it out as this a linear combination of everything that was inside of that function. We also have scalar tensors, which are basically, they're scalars, but in general, they're a tensor. And so we put this as type 0, 0, meaning 0 upper indices, 0 lower indices is a scalar. And you have a vector, which is a generalization of a tensor, and that's got 1 upper indice, no lower indices. And you've got a dual type, which is that no upper and 1 lower. And then you can, in general, you can have any number of upper and lower indices. You can have 54 and 97 if you want, and it's a tensor. But remember, the indice can be either high or low. It could be upper or lower, nothing else.
And what's the difference between the upper or
lower? The upper is contravariant. The lower is covariant. So it means whether or not you're going to be mapping mapping something that looks like a vector or like a dual. In Cartesian coordinates, remember, there really is no difference between a vector and a dual. Now, the tensor product, and we often write this as an X with a circle around it, not an advertisement for X-Men. This is something where if you have a tensor of the kind with K upper and L lower indices, and you have another tensor with M upper and N lower, then taking this tensor product is going to give you a total of K plus M upper and L plus N lower. In other words, you're just kind of adding up the indices, and it's just kind of taking two tensors and putting them together into a bigger tensor. And you'll notice that taking the tensor product of T and S is not the same as taking the tensor product of S and T. Same way that if you were to take two matrices, and you know, matrices you can almost think of as tensors, and they're square matrices, and which order you multiply them in is going to matter. So they don't necessarily commute. We also have basis tensors, where the idea is you have all of these basis from vectors and from duals, and they can be combined through tensor products as well to give you the tensor basis. And so here, for example, you've got T, which is a scalar, and you've got, this is the, what we normally think of as the tensor with all the indices on it, and then you have the basis, all the different basis vectors kind of combined. And so this can be thought of as simply taking your tensor and then each one of the vectors and duals. So what this is what you mean, what we mean by this linear action or linear function. So one thing about tensors is that they act a lot like vectors when it comes to transformations. And so in this case, you got this tensor, and you notice these are primed here. And it is got these transformations, assume they're Lorentz transformations, and they're acting on the tensor with the unprimed, and it transforms each of them. But you'll notice here that this transformation here, which is kind of looks like the kind of transformation you use on a covariant vector, each one of these is needed for each indice. So with a vector, you basically have one transformation, one vector. For a tensor, you've got to have one transformation per indice, and then you have to have more transformations to transform the covariant parts. And so those transform these guys transform these. And you'll notice that the primes are at the top for the contravariant transformation. They're at the bottom for the covariant transformation. And so the upper indices transform like vectors, lower indices transform like dual vectors. So you can almost think of a tensor as just being a bunch of vectors and dual vectors just crammed together and written out in shorthand. And so if you literally take two vectors, you put them together, that's a tensor. Take a vector and a dual, put them together, and the indices aren't the same, and you don't sum over them, that's a tensor. So you can think now that you have this tensor, where you have an upper and a lower indice, and you can have this tensor acting on some vector. And what this is it's a map from a vector to a tensor and a vector. And so what this means is if you have this one indice here, and if you're assuming you sum over these two indices, then you're basically left with something with one indice again. And this is a contraction. So we have, basically you can go from being a vector to a tensor, or a tensor and a vector combination back to a vector or whatever. Now, you know, that's all kind of abstract since we haven't actually said what we're doing. We're just kind of talking about symbols. Now, we also have this inner dot or scalar product where you've got this combination here is basically a tensor and two vectors. And we can write it here in terms of the indices, ignoring the basis, where we have the tensor, as we normally think of it, and then the two vectors. And what happens is this eta here is just like the Minkowski space eta. And when you take two vectors and you multiply them with that, it's basically the dot product of the two. So the metric, in general, acts like the tensor operator, which does a dot product. In terms of flat space, it's easier to see. Now, if you have two vectors and they're orthogonal, that means the inner product or the scalar product is zero, just like in linear algebra. Because you're going through this operation, they're dotting each other. And you can imagine you have two vectors, like say one of them is just in the x direction and one of them is just in the y direction. And if you did this with linear algebra, you could see how they would end up with zero as a scalar product. And that's basically what's happening. The norm is the inner product of a vector with itself. And remember that these are four vectors, four-dimensional vectors, so you can actually do this, and you can imagine you still have the 0, 0 component here, which is minus 1, and then you multiply it out, and you can actually get a negative number when you do that scalar product. And if you get a negative number in that case, it's time-like. If it's 0, it's light-like or null. If it's greater, it's space-like. And so we can kind of define our vectors and break them down into categories like that. Before, when we're just looking at tensors as three-dimensional objects, we only had space-like or null. We didn't have time-like. And the ironic thing is most, you know, pretty much everything we know moves along time-like vectors through space-time. The next thing I'm talking about is the Kronecker delta. And the idea here is it's an identity map. So it's basically, if you, in linear algebra, it's just ones down the diagonal. And so if you take this Minkowski space metric and you contract it, the inverse metric, with itself, the result is going to be ones going down the diagonal. And so this, when you raise these indices on the metric, we call that the inverse metric for that reason. And it commutes with itself. So it doesn't matter which order you do it in. And so this Kronecker delta is just simply ones down the diagonal. Either mu and rho are equal to each other, and it's one, otherwise they're zero. Okay. Next thing I want to introduce is the Levi-Civita symbol. And I think that's probably like one of the hardest things to pronounce we're going to get to in this class, so that's not too bad. This is not a tensor. It's what they call a tensor density. And the reason why it's not considered a tensor is because it does not transform like a tensor. If you transform the basis or you do a Lorentz transform or whatever, it doesn't change. And what this is, it's an anti-symmetric symbol. And symbol means that it looks like a tensor. It's got indices, but it's not a tensor. And it has a property that if mu, nu, rho, and sigma are all different, then it's equal to plus 1. And then if you permutate any two of these, or any, so you take rho and sigma, you switch them around, it's equal to minus 1. If you have to do two switches, like you switch these two around and you switch mu and nu around, you get back to plus 1. So it's always going to be plus 1, minus 1, or 0, and 0 happens if you repeat any of these. So what happens is the number of indices on the Levi-Civita always equals the number of dimensions in your space-time, or less. Because if you think about it, if you got a three-dimensional space-time, and you're summing over all dimensions, eventually you're going to have to repeat, and you get 0. You got a four-dimensional space-time, this could be 0, 1, 2, 3, and you're all set. And the nice thing about this Levi-Civita is that it can be used to calculate cross products. It can also be used to calculate determinants. So mathematically, it's a very useful tool. It's just, you know, not. It's just so general that it just isn't used a lot in the earlier classes. But you may remember that from the math methods course. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so next I want to talk a little bit about tensors in flat space specifically. And so we're going to start with the flat space, and then of course over the next few weeks we'll work our way up to doing more curved or more interesting space. So we've got the metric, the inverse metric, the Kronecker delta, and the Levi-Civita symbol as these different things we've introduced, all of which are the same in any inertial coordinate system in flat space-time. That means that, like, doesn't matter how an observer is moving, in a flat Minkowski space, they're always going to see a flat Minkowski space. It's never going to transform. The metric, it's not going to change. The inverse metric by relationship, it's Kronecker delta is kind of fixed. The Levi-Civita, not going to change. And so we're going to look at the first one of the first tensors that we got introduced to, and this is the electromagnetic field strength tensor. And so this F mu nu is written in terms of the electric field and the magnetic field. It's an anti-symmetric tensor, so it's got zeros down the diagonal. Like all anti-symmetric tensors have to be zero down the diagonal. Everybody know why? Think about it. If it's anti-symmetric, then what happens is this should be equal to this. Right? And so if we make these the same,
they're equal to their opposite,
then it has to be zero. So that's just a little something just to notice. So anytime we say a tensor is anti-symmetric, by definition, that's going to be one of the characteristics. With a symmetric tensor, it doesn't really matter what you put down the diagonal, because when you flip, when you do the transpose, it's going to be the same diagonal either way. But that also means that you could see that every one of these are negative, where all these are positive. And you flip signs between them. Okay. Now, if this is just a quick example of the tensor we're going to work with, then we have to look at how do you manipulate tensors, because about 70 to 80% of the stuff you're going to do in this class is going to involve manipulating tensors. So it's the most useful skill to learn. The stuff that you're going to do in here that doesn't involve manipulating tensors is not going to be very much. And so you'll find some of your homework, you're going to be just doing tensors the entire thing. Now, for manipulating tensors, we've got several operations we can do. One of them called contractions. And a contraction is where you have two indices that are being repeated. In this case, nu. And if you sum over those two indices, then effectively you're eliminating these indices. And you get a new tensor with that index eliminated. And anytime you have a contravariant and covariant indices and they're the same, you can contract over it. If they're different, then, of course, they're different. They can't necessarily be contracted. And so this is not necessarily the same as this, where I've switched these two, the order of these two. Because here, what's happening is we don't know that switching the order of these two, if it's symmetric or anti-symmetric with respect to those. We have no way of knowing. We don't even know what T whatever is. So that's the first thing to learn. And sometimes when you do contractions, you might actually have something like a tensor and a vector. Or actually, make it a metric term like this. And you might contract over these and get a new tensor. And that's a contraction. And so this is just an operation we've done. We didn't even say what T is. We're assuming the G is the metric, but it could be, may not be. One thing we do know is if this was the metric, we know it's symmetric because the metric is by definition symmetric. If this is the stress energy tensor, we know that that's also symmetric.
That was anti-symmetric.
No, that's the electromagnetic field tensor is anti-symmetric. The stress energy tensor, on the other hand, is symmetric. So if you know what you're representing, then you can do a little bit more with it. But for the most part, you can't. So for the most part, you basically don't know what these things are. And you have to kind of just go with whatever the math will tell you. The other thing is you can raise or lower indices. And this is where the metric comes in. In this case, the Minkowski metric. Here, putting a Minkowski metric allows you to raise or lower the indices on a tensor. So if you've got this tensor here, and you want to lower this indice down to the bottom and go from contravariant to covariant, you can do it by just simply pulling out an inverse metric term, and then that does that. Because what happens here is, on this side, you can see that if you contract over these two indices, the result is basically putting this indice over here and raising it back up. So, likewise, if you got this tensor, where you have down, up, and then two more down, that's the same thing as if you have this tensor with a metric term, where you could see that you simply contract over these two indices, and the result is lowering this indice down. So the metric term lets you go from contravariant to covariant, and the inverse metric lets you go from covariant to contravariant or whatever. And you can see here you've got a contravariant vector. You lower the indice, you have a covariant vector. Here you've got a covariant vector, raise the indice, becomes a contravariant. And you can do this all day. So the nice thing is, if you run into having a vector and it's contravariant, you need a covariant, or vice versa, you can just throw in a metric term and do it. And I'll show you some other neat stuff with the metric, too. One thing about it is, when we get to covariant derivatives, I can go in more detail about what else we can do with that. Another thing is that if you have a contravariant and a covariant vector like this, so obviously this is going to form a kind of a dot product situation, you could see that you can actually use the metric terms here to turn this contravariant vector into a covariant vector, and this covariant vector into a contravariant vector, and then you got the two metric terms left over. Now, what the nice thing about tensors is the order that you write these in doesn't matter. All they're going to do is sum over like terms, even if the terms aren't next to each other. So you can rearrange this thing to put these two metric and inverse metric next to each other, and then you can contract them together, which gives you this Kronecker delta. And you're left with the two vectors. Well, this Kronecker delta says that these two indices have to be the same, so it makes these two indices the same, which gives you covariant, contravariant. And so what this proves is that when you're doing a dot product, it doesn't matter which is the co and which is the contra, they still contract together to give you the same scalar. And so this is just sort of a quick proof using all the stuff that we learned about raising and lowering indices and contracting. We've also got the difference between symmetric and anti-symmetric. Now, for a symmetric tensor, what that means is I switch two of these indices around, and the result is the same thing. Anti-symmetric means I switch two of them around, and I get minus that same tensor. So what we can do is we can symmetrize or anti-symmetrize our tensors, so that if we have a mathematical property where we only want the anti-symmetric part or the symmetric part, we can build that. And so here you could see this is a tensor, and you could see these parentheses here. And the parentheses is sort of a it's sort of a shorthand meaning symmetrize. And so you could see here that what you do is you take 1 over n factorial, where n factorial, n is the number of indices here. And so, and you take your tensor and you sum it up over every different permutation of that tensor over the symmetrized part. So you've got t, mu1, mu2, etc. The next one's going to be t, mu2, mu1, etc. And then they're just going to keep going through every different possible combination of them. And as you know from math methods, there should be n factorial of those. And so you add them all up, and then you divide by that. And what happens is the result is going to be a tensor that's going to be symmetric with respect to all of the different permutations. And then you can anti-symmetrize the tensors by basically doing a similar operation, but we're going to use square brackets to show anti-symmetry. And this one, you're going to do the same thing, but you're going to alternate plus and minus for the permutations. So you'd make one change, you do a minus. You make it two changes, you do a plus. You make three changes, it's a minus, and so on. And so what ends up happening then is that under the change of any one indice, or any two indices, it's minus. Under the exchange of two sets of indices, it's plus, and so on. So you end up anti-symmetrizing it the same way. And the nice thing about it is that this works with any number of indices. You can literally have a million indices in a billion dimensions, and this will still hold exactly right. And I mean, and without this kind of math, you couldn't do something like string theory. We have 10 dimensions, and you have all these indices floating around. The one danger is that if you run into using too many indices, you'll run out of letters in the alphabet. And you, the Greek alphabet only has so many letters. The English alphabet, the Latin alphabet only has so many letters. You may have to start inventing symbols, you know. Who knows? You know, start writing it in Klingon symbols or whatever. Now, another thing you can do is you can put in these bars, which basically mean ignore everything in these bars for your symmetry. So that way, if you want to have the symmetric, but you want it only on the exchange of these two, and they don't happen to be next to each other, you can symmetrize it, put in these bars so that these two don't really matter, but the exchange of these two does. In which case, you do your sum and you alternate these two, but you don't alternate anything else. And if it's just two of them in here, it's really easy to see why this is symmetric.
Why would it not matter the order of two of the indices?
Remember that the indices, well, you don't know exactly what this tensor function is. Okay? So it could be that this could be like, I don't know, it's hard to picture when you get to more than two sets of indices. But, you know, or if you have just two indices, you can think of it in, like, in terms of linear algebra. When you get to more than two indices, it becomes really difficult to draw it. But let's just say that this was some kind of mathematical operation, where these indices could end up fitting into sines and cosines and times this or an exponential of that or whatever. Okay? In that case, what happens is that this could be some very, very complex function, and switching the order from here over to here, say switching the order of mu and rho, is not going to give you the same thing. Or it's not going to give you the same function. I mean, typically that may not, that's probably not going to be true if you're designing and building the function or the tensor, but it's possible that you might end up with something where it literally is a different thing by switching those two. I guess an example of that would be the Riemann tensor, where in the Riemann tensor, trying to think if it's symmetric with respect to the second and fourth indices. But I know that you end up contracting over those two to get you the Ricci. But you can, let me see. The Weil tensor is a good example. If you look on page 130 in the book, because the Weil tensor, it is, if you anti-symmetrize the first set and the second set of indices, then you get, it's got that symmetry to it, and you can flip around, you can flip around those two sets and get the same result. But when you switch, like, say, the second and the fourth indices, then it's not the same thing. So you can end up with a situation where you're literally not, it's not the same thing. So you can't put those two next to each other. But I see what you're saying. It's not easy to see why you would do that. And it's not something that you would use a lot. But it is something that's a possibility. Also, you notice if you take the symmetrized version and the anti-symmetrized version, you add them together, you get back to your regular tensor. And so the nice thing about this is that, like, let's say you have a anti-symmetric tensor and you're contracting it with a symmetric tensor, the result is going to be zero because of the fact that it can't be both anti-symmetric and symmetric at the same time. So what you do is if you have a general tensor and you're contracting with an anti-symmetric tensor, you know that only the anti-symmetric part is going to matter, so you can anti-symmetrize it and, you know, shave off some dead weight. But you notice here, If you're symmetrized over three indices and anti-symmetrized over those three, it doesn't add up to the same original one. It's only if it's an even number. You've also got the trace, which is defined just like in linear algebra, where the trace is the sum down the diagonal. And then next we have these things called partial derivatives. And they're sort of like the partial derivatives from calculus you're used to. And in flat space, these are going to be linear. And in flat space, a partial derivative is like a tensor operation. And so what a partial derivative can do is it can act like an operator. It's linear, so it can act like an operator, and therefore you can do all the same mathematics with it, and as a tensor or a vector or covariant vector. In general, this is not true, and when we get to curved space, we have to use what we call a covariant derivative and replace the partial derivative. Okay. Anything there? Any questions? Okay. Moving along. All right. This is the part I'm sure you guys just couldn't wait to see. Maxwell's equations. And so for those of you who haven't seen these in a few months, the idea here is that these are the basic equations that define electrodynamics. And so this is Maxwell's equations written for a case where you have a source. So you've got current, charge density, and then there's electric and magnetic field terms. And what happens is you can take your Maxwell's equations written like this, and you can rewrite them using your tensors. In this case, you could see that you've replaced the curl with the Levi-Civita contracted between a partial derivative. So the partial derivative, you can see if this is J and this is K, then you contract it with these, you get something in the ith direction. And you know,
you're summing it up over all indices.
Right. We're using what they call the Einstein summation convention, which means anytime you see a repeated indice, it means you have to sum over it. A repeated covariant contravariant, not necessarily if they're both covariant or both contravariant. And then you could see that when you do a time derivative, it's the zeroth derivative here. And you notice here that I had to make this covariant because when you do the summation, you get contravariant. And this is contravariant and this is contravariant. Here, the divergence is just taking covariant with contravariant and using this partial derivative as an operator. And the zeroth dimension for current is charge.
Okay.
You know, just like in Jackson.
Because there's no spatial
dimension. Yeah, you can think of like you're dealing with four current here. And so current, as we normally think of it, three current is just charges flowing. And then distribution or charge density is just current flowing forward in time. So that's where that comes from. The again, with this equation, you've got the curl, which comes from the Levi-Civita. You've got the time derivative here. And then here is the divergence. So we've basically rewritten Maxwell's equations in terms of these tensors. And we can actually take this further, and since we know the electromagnetic field tensor, the parts on the outside of it, along the time-like components, are the electric field, and the interior parts are the magnetic field, then we can take the electric field parts and we can replace them with this. And we can take the magnetic field and we can replace it with this. So if we do that, now the Maxwell's equations simplify to this, where you can see here we've got, let's see,
just kind of going through term by term. This here is just Fij. This is just the zero term.
So you can see that if you take
this equation here, the whole thing is just this.
Likewise, this equation is just going to be this one. And so two of Maxwell's equations are just going to be this. And in general, you could see that here you're summing over j, j, 0, 0. And here you're summing over I, I. So these are literally the same thing. So both of these are actually just this, if you write it in terms of four dimensions. Because we're summing over the first indice and the last indice here. Just like here, if you flip the sign, you know, because it's anti-symmetric, here you're summing over second indice, here you're summing over second indice. You just have to allow your indices to go from zero through all the spatial indices, and this is equivalent to that. So this is the entire rewriting of half of Maxwell's equations right there. So that the divergence of the electromagnetic force field tensor is just the current, four current. You also notice that this electromagnetic field tensor has the property that if you anti-symmetrize this and you take this divergence, this partial derivative of this, anti-symmetrize is going to be zero, which is where you take this derivative and you just commute the thing around and commute the terms. And this is just a property of the tensor when you correctly assign what it is and you use Maxwell's equations. So this is a nice way of writing Maxwell's equations. And then later on, we're let's see. There's a thing called the dual of the tensor that we use when we talk about Maxwell's equations. He doesn't really go into it in here. But basically, if you apply this dual operation, then you get the other half of Maxwell's equations over here, where the dual is defined as, I don't know if I skipped it or if he just didn't put it in here. Well, the dual is defined like something like this. Like if this is the dual, I think it's like one half, and you take the Levi-Civita of the electromagnetic field tensor. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, that's just off the top of my head. And so if you do this, then you can go back and you can replace these equations with ones. By basically, when you do this, then, let's see, the dual 0i becomes like the magnetic field terms, and the dual ij becomes like this Levi-Civita with the electric field terms. So it becomes the opposite. And the net result is going to be partial mu of the dual equals zero. And so then this is the second half of Maxwell's equations. And you can kind of go back and fill in some of the gaps in what I did there. But the whole idea is that we can reduce, since this dual operation, if you just take for granted that you know what this dual operation is, you can apply the dual operation to this and see that this really represents all four of Maxwell's equations. Or you can write it as this and its dual give you Maxwell's equations. But that's essentially the rest of it. All right, now moving on to talk about energy and momentum. You've got a single particle world line map, which maps a real number to this thing called a manifold. And this manifold is what's going to represent space-time. We're going to spend all of Chapter 2 talking about manifolds, so don't feel like you're missing anything yet. Now, assuming that we're following some curve, x mu, which is parameterized by lambda, and it is tangent to the curve, partial x mu, partial lambda, then we are interested in the norm of the tangent vector if the tangent vector is time-like, null, or space-like at that certain parameter. Then we say that the path is time-like, null, or space-like at that point. And so what this means in more simple language is that if you can imagine you're traveling through curved space or you're traveling on top of a curved planet like Earth, and you're following this path, x mu, then the tangent to the curve is always given by taking the derivative with respect to some parameter. In this case, it looks something like velocity. And so we say that your path is, if you're going along a time-like path, and the tangent vector is time-like, then we say your path is time-like at that particular point. You can't say globally, because you don't really know what's going on globally. You only know what's going on at that particular tangent to the curve, which is only relevant at that point. So we have a four velocity, which we define to be the derivative of the path coordinate with respect to proper time. And this proper time squared comes from taking minus, and then this is basically the metric contracting with the dx term, so this is just the path length with the minus sign on it. And so for proper time, this is going to give you zero, or give you minus one. And this is really one of these things I think is a lot more profound than it looks, because what's happening here is if you can imagine you're not moving at all, you're standing still, then your space-time vector looks like this. Okay? And so if you look at this and you take a scalar product of it with itself, you're obviously going to get one. Because, you know, you got one at this point and you got one on the other point. What's happening according to special relativity is, let's say you're moving at relativistic speed in the x direction. Well, this might be 0.9, and this might be 0.1 and 0.0, something like that. And when you calculate it all out, this is still going to come out to 1. Because you're not moving as far ahead in time, but you're moving more in space. And so you can kind of work out the numbers to where this is always going to be equal to 1. When you do that dot product, and this shows you that this is assuming special relativity works. Or sorry, it should be minus one, because of the metric with that minus sign in it. But anyway, so this is basically saying that your four velocity always has magnitude minus one.
Always.
Always. Doesn't matter if you're time-like, space-like, or null. It's always going to be minus one for any of these paths. So, because if you really think about it, even if you're talking about light, it's going to be moving equally in time and space, and it's still going to end up with the same thing. And for space-like vectors, it's still going to be the same thing. So the four momentum also is going to give you a four vector. And what happens here is you can take the mass, you multiply by this four velocity, and that gives you four momentum. And you can break it up into a time-like part, which is basically energy, E equals mc squared. And then you have the space-like part, which is your momentum. And so this is the three momentum, which is going to be gamma terms involved.
And we're taking c equal to 1 to simplify things, and gamma is equal to 1 over square root of 1 minus v squared. And so what happens is, if you take the velocity and you make it really, really small, the energy ends up becoming the rest energy plus 1 half mv squared, and the momentum is just mv.
That's a classical limit.
And that's a classical limit. And if you contract over all the space and time-like components, you're always going to get minus m squared. Well, we're ignoring the c equals 1 term. So actually this would be minus m squared c to the fourth if you include c. And the energy is then equal to square root of m squared plus p squared, ignoring the c squared terms. So what happens is, again, our energy is always going to obey that. It's always going to have this four momentum is always going to have a full magnitude minus m squared. Just like four velocity has magnitude minus one. Now, in Newtonian physics, we've got F equals ma is equal to the change in momentum with respect to time. But what happens in relativity is that time is relative now, so that makes it a little bit harder to figure out exactly what that means. And so in relativity, you've got this is the force, and it's mass times acceleration, where the acceleration is calculated in terms of proper time. And that's like the proper time derivative of momentum. And so we can think of force electrodynamically as being equal to the Lorentz force here. And that leads us to having this force equation using the electromagnetic field tensor. And actually, speaking of books earlier, there's a very good discussion in the Lorentz book about why it is that this is the force equation and why this is defined as the electromagnetic field tensor. It's in a chapter on relativistic electrodynamics. We have to look in the table of contents to find it. But basically, they looked at different ways you could try to construct force using this observer or lack of an observer and the charge. And this just comes out as the best way to do it. Now, next thing I want to talk about is the energy momentum tensor. And this is going to be important because, you know, like this is representing the right-hand side of Einstein's equations. So we know we're going to see it a lot more. And the way that they start talking about the energy momentum tensor is really considering a fluid system, where it's pretty easy to understand. And the T00 component represents the flux of energy in the time direction. In other words, it's like power, how much energy is moving forward in time. In the rest frame, energy density rho. And the T0i or I0, you can see this is symmetric, represent the momentum density. How is momentum flowing through the system? Tij is the momentum flux of stress. And then the diagonal components are pressure. So in a simple fluid system, you might just have rho, which is the rest energy density, and then the pressure going down the diagonal. The number flux 4 vector, n, mu, is represented by the number of particles of dust you might have, and then this is the four velocities of them. So you can basically just take all of these different particles of dust. You know, if you want to assume a simple system, you assume dust, because dust doesn't have pressure. It's the simplest fluid system you can get to. And so then the rest frame energy density is just the mass of each dust particle times the number of the dust particles. And so you just have that one term. And then rho T mu nu for dust is just going to come from the tensor product of pressure times the number density. And then you could see that this ends up becoming, times rho. That's rho, momentum, times number density. Because there's no pressure, sorry. So this is this should be rho. And so you could see that this is your energy and your number. And so we rewrite that as mn. That's supposed to be momentum. And so that's basically just going to be 4 velocity times the mass. And meanwhile, the number density comes from the 4 velocity times n, the number of particles. And so you end up with just mn times the 4 velocity terms, which is just rho, the rest energy density, times the 4 velocity terms. And then there is no pressure because it's dust. Dust doesn't give you pressure. And so this is the simplest system where you have, if these are the 4 velocity terms, and assuming that these particles aren't moving, then they're just going to be 1 followed by zeros. So you're only going to have a term right there in that upper left-hand corner of your matrix. All the rest are going to be 0. In a perfect fluid, on the other hand, you do have pressure. And so you have just the diagonal components, and you have rho when P is down the diagonal, assuming that the fluid's at rest. And you write this as basically being rho plus P with the 4 velocity term, and you got P times the metric term here. So it's like it adds P up here, and then it subtracts it. And so this is the end result. And you can basically go from this back to the dust picture by just setting pressure equal to 0. If you've got an isotropic gas, then pressure is equal to 1/3 rho. So that what happens effectively is that the pressure cancels out with the energy density. And for vacuum energy, you've got the energy density of the vacuum times this eta term. And so, in which case, you could see that here, where it's almost like...
Are those P's pressure or momentum?
Oh, these P's are pressure.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry to use the same symbol. If it's got a vector on it, an indice, then it's momentum. If otherwise, it's pressure. Also, one property of the energy momentum tensor is it's a constant tensor. So if you take the divergence of it, you should get 0. And you can see here that what we're doing here is we're taking the divergence of it, and you can see taking the divergence of this term and doing the full chain rule on each term. And then a divergence on the pressure term here after we've applied this raising indice effect. And then we go through term by term, and you could see that this is neat. Take the 4 velocity and the derivative of the 4 velocity. And that is the same thing as taking 1/2 times the derivative of both of these, according to chain rule, right? Because you're going to apply it to one, and then you're going to apply it to the other, and covariant, contravariant, doesn't matter. Well, this is equal to -1, always. So when you take the derivative of that, you get 0. What this means is that this you can think of as acceleration, and this you can think of as 4 velocity. And so what that's saying is the acceleration is orthogonal to the 4 velocity. This term... So that takes care of these two terms right here. Now, as far as this term goes, what happened?
what happens here is if they take this 4 velocity and they multiply it by this, they can kind of eliminate one of these 4 velocity terms here. And you've got the derivative with respect to the density times 4 velocity, and the derivative here, you've got a derivative of pressure, and you have another derivative of pressure here, which I guess they're saying kind of cancel each other out, and then you've got this derivative of 4 velocity here. And so when we go through and we do that, we multiply in by this other 4 velocity term, and we could see that this gives us minus 1 here, and this gives us a minus 1 here, and these terms with multiples just kind of drop out. And then we've got this last term with the derivative and the 4 velocity and the derivative of the pressure. And so what happens is that this first term is minus all this, is this term. And then these two terms you can group together because you've got, let's see, this term, actually these two terms are identical. And I think I got a little bit ahead of myself. Oh, I see what they did. They used this term here to kind of eliminate, I think, this other term here. So then this term involving the derivative of pressure was kind of expanded out with the inverse chain rule. So if they take the derivative of this whole thing, and then they subtract out the part where they're taking the derivative of the 4 velocity, then the result is this guy. And so this right here, you've got derivatives which are going to apply to each one of these. And so when you take the derivative of rho and mu, that gives you this term. When you take the derivative of the pressure in this term, it eliminates this one. And then you're left with this guy. So now you've got something a little bit better. And you've got your 4 velocity, which you break up into 1 and then all the 3 velocity terms, which is roughly right, where these are considered to be very, very tiny compared to 1. So they're much less than the speed of light. And pressure is considered to be much less than energy density for most things. So in other words, imagine, you know, you've got a hot gas. For your gas to get to the point where pressure is greater than the energy density, you got to be talking about early universe type conditions. And so this is a very non-relativistic fluid. If you assume that case, then this can simplify down into basically conservation of particle density. So it just ends up looking just like a conservation equation. And because you can see that, you know, we're ignoring, we're basically saying it's 4 velocities like 1, and the time derivative term is going to dominate. That gives you this term. And then here, this term, you've got basically your derivative of rho times velocity, which comes from the spatial part, from here. And then for this guy, you're saying that, well, this is basically constant, so this term just falls out because the pressure is much less than the density. And these velocities are so tiny that they're not helping anything. And so this is a way of just saying, well, you have the fact that you have the divergence of your stress energy tensor equals 0 means that you have a conservation law. Okay.
Now, next I want to introduce the projection tensor. And the idea of this thing is, basically, it's to project things onto the perpendicular. So you can see here, you've got this delta function, and you have these two four velocity terms. And if you apply this to a velocity that's moving parallel, then the result is going to be zero.
Parallel to what?
Parallel to the four velocity of the particle. So in other words, if you're talking about having a time-like particle, it's just, you know, if your observer just sitting still, parallel means something else that's also moving time-like. And perpendicular would mean moving something space-like. And so if you apply this projection tensor to that, then what happens is you get, you can see you have your delta function acting on it first. And then you have these four velocity terms, and this ends up giving you a minus one, in which case the minus one and the plus one there end up canceling out. But with the perpendicular, which would be going from space-like instead of time-like, then you end up getting something that should work. And the way to check this is you could see that parallel basically means you're parallel to the four velocity. So if you just think of a simple time-like, you can check that. Perpendicular means perpendicular to that. And so the idea of this is it can kind of filter out anything that happens to be moving with you and give you a chance to mathematically distinguish the stuff that's moving in some other direction. So if we apply this projection tensor to this divergence, then we have to apply each one of these to all this stuff. And the first thing that happens here, as you can see, you have your, the first one ends up going to zero. And I guess the reason why is because, by definition, this is going to be parallel to that. So it should go to zero. And then for the other ones, it's going to be a little bit more complicated. We actually have to work through it. And so the second term drops out, or the second two terms drop out because of that rule that we found where the acceleration was basically perpendicular to the four velocity. And then, so that killed this term and this term, and this term would also die. And so we're left with this, because these are different indices, and we're left with this term. Oh, and that one. So that simplifies things down a lot. And so now we can rewrite this where we're going to take the density and pressure terms and we separate them out. And then just rewrite these two terms here. And now, and also you notice we changed indices here. And that's one other rule for dealing with tensors. Anytime you're summing over an indice, you can change that indice. Because it's going to get summed over, it doesn't matter what it is. And so mathematically, you might change the indice just so it matches up with everything else. And so now, you can take, let's see, this term and this term, and you can kind of look at it like a chain rule thing. Like here you're taking a derivative with respect to the sigma term, and here you're taking a derivative with respect to P. So if you group those two together and put the other terms out front, then that works. And then you can, this term is the same, this other term is the same. And so now, I guess what we did was we just recombined these, I think they just added in another term. Actually, recombine these two to give you this term. And you can see the last term is the same. Here's the derivative on the pressure. and then the sigma term, the 2-4 velocities are here, and then the rest of it was recombined with this one. And so basically we're saying that all of this is that projection tensor acting on the divergence of the stress tensor. And so in a new relativistic limit, a non-relativistic limit, this should be equal to zero. And the rest of this can be written as, well, the density dominates over pressure, so we can forget about pressure. And you can think of this, first we think about the time component. So this is just one, and this is just going to be a time derivative of the 4 velocity, which is this velocity here. And then this term is going to be, let's see, if we take a spatial derivative here, then these two are in the same direction. So this is going to be velocity, and then this is going to be the del operator in the same direction, and that's another velocity term. And then this is pressure, so this doesn't really matter in the non-relativistic limit. And then we've got a gradient of pressure here. And, oh, I guess actually this does, because this isn't directly adding. So what happens here is, first there's a time component, where you're taking a time derivative of this, which gives you time here and velocity, so it gives you this term. And then the spatial derivative, which gives you this term. And so this is actually something that looks like a Navier-Stokes type equation. And since velocity is small and pressure is much less than density, you can rewrite this thing again as this. And as you can see, this looks like Navier-Stokes. So the idea here is that, you know, you could show that this stuff works, and then you can just take it to a non-relativistic limit and see that it gives you a classical equation that you'd expect to see. Okay. All right, so that's it for the notes for today. Any questions? Not every class has to be 2.5 hours long. And I think I gave you guys enough to think about. If anybody's bored, you know, I gave you some stuff to read. You can think about that, too. So, any questions on the homework while we're here? Yeah?
Let me see. I actually have questions on 1 and 3.
1 and 3. Okay. For problem number 1, consider an inertial frame S with coordinates x mu equals tx, y, and z, and the frame S prime with coordinates x mu prime related to S by a boost, the velocity parameter v along the y-axis. Imagine you have a wall at rest at x prime lying in the x prime equals minus y prime. From the point of view of S, what is the relationship between the incident angle of the ball hitting the mirror and the reflected angle when the velocity... Okay.
My assumption is that it should be the same as its invariant.
Well, think about it like this. You've got here... You got this inertial frame S, and the S prime frame is moving along the y axis.
Right.
Right? And the wall is going along x prime equals minus y prime.
Right.
So the wall is actually defined in the primed frame,
right,
as being slanted, right?
45-degree.
At a 45-degree angle in the primed frame.
Right.
Which means, of course, that when you take into account length, contraction and stuff, it's really not a 45-degree angle in the S prime.
Right.
So, if you have a ball hitting the mirror traveling in the XY plane, so basically this ball's coming in and it's going to, in the S prime frame. Okay, look at it in the S prime frame first. If the ball comes in and it hits the mirror, angle of incidence is going to equal angle of reflection. It's going to bounce off. So from the S prime frame, it's going to be the same angle both ways. However, in the S frame, it's going to actually see a moving mirror. So it's going to hit, and it's going to be in contact longer and reflect off. So that's why you would expect to see it at a different angle. And what's going to have to happen is you're going to have to look at how much is the mirror moving and why, you know, because, well, I mean, you don't have to do this exactly, but you can imagine if it's going to, let's say it's in contact for like a tenth of a second and bounces off in a at that angle, then in the S frame, they're not going to be in contact for a tenth of a second. They're going to be in contact longer. And so what you need to do really is to kind of do the calculation in the S prime frame and then translate everything into the S frame. And then you'll see the result. But it shouldn't be... I wouldn't expect that the angle of incidence and the angle of reflection being the same thing. And it actually kind of leaves it up to you as far as what is the angle it's hitting at. Because it could be a straight head-on collision. It could be that it's coming in right... parallel to the X direction, you know, like right along the Y direction and doing it, you don't know. Okay? And then for problem three, you got three events, A, B, and C, seen by an observer, and to occur in the order A, B, C. Another observer sees the events as C, B, A. Is it possible the third observer sees the order in ACB? Okay?
The question here is just a proper way to draw a space-time
diagram. Oh. A proper way of drawing a space-time diagram, it's really not that proper. Like, you can literally... all you're really looking for is typically time is this way, X would be this way. So as long as you've got two different axes, one representing space and one representing time, you can do whatever you want.
Okay, and with respect to that, how do the events A, B, and C fit into there? Well, in this one, that I'm having trouble conceptualizing A, B, and C seen in that order on space.
Okay, well, if in this case, let's say your observer is right here at the origin, okay? Which means he's at zero time and zero space. And he might see the events as A, B, C like this. And it could be that simple. That he's not moving, and A, B, and C, they're events. So they could represent the guy's driving along on the road and a bunch of cones just start popping out. And he hits them. And he hits one and the other and then the other. So in each collision with a cone could represent an event. Or A, B, C could be scattered, where this is A and this is B and this is C. But anyway, since he's saying these are time sequence things, all he knows is that A happens before B, which happens before C in time.
In his reference frame.
In his reference frame. From his spot at the origin where these things aren't moving, or where he's not moving. So you can kind of put in another observer who might be located at a different location than him. I mean, the only rule here is that, you know, this thing needs to be physically possible. So you don't want to put your observer into your diagram who's not moving in time forward. Like, you can't have a time traveler coming backwards in time and have him see things in a different order.
The reverse order.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I thought about this problem. It seemed like the only way I could make... I couldn't imagine being in a different reference frame. I could come up with no case for a flat time space. Maybe it wasn't flat. So then I found equation 1.77.
Okay.
On page 26.
Okay. Of course, with this problem, you shouldn't have to do any equations.
Well, I wasn't doing very good visualization, but that equation seemed to me...
Because it's symmetric?
Yeah, that was my justification, that I couldn't ever see it in any other order.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, that has nothing to do with order. I mean, one way of looking at this is he sees things as A, B, C, and you want to have another person that sees things as C, B, A?
Yes.
Right? Okay, let's suppose here's our space-time diagram. Here's our observer, okay? Here's A, here's B, and here's C, as he sees them. Now, let's suppose, and this is all in his light cone, like this. And so let's say these are fireworks going off, and this is the time it takes light to get to them. Now, let's suppose I have another observer here. You know, he's at the other end of the park or whatever. And he's going to have a light cone also. From his perspective, C happens closer, because the space-time distance from here to here is closer. So he sees C first, and then B, and then A. Now, can you tweak this in such a way? I think the question was, can somebody see things A, C, B? So maybe there could be some modification going on here to where somebody sees a space-time distance from here, then here, then here. And then you have to kind of go back and forth between the three to make sure it works. Because really, when you observe something, all that's really happening is that the space-time distance from this event to you is shorter than the space-time distance from this event to here. Or, you know, so basically, the time it took to get the light from here to here was shorter than the time from here to here and from here to here. Yeah.
Well, I can't exactly do it so well with light, but I can do it with thunder, mm-hmm. lightning, because there I'm for sure knowing, because it's moving slow,
yeah.
that I can imagine three lightning bolts, and the guy that's under me is going to think he got there mm-hmm. first, even though it was... Looking down from bird's eye view, it was definitely A, B, C.
Right, and you can also take into account, like, maybe it's a moving observer. You know, maybe the observer is coming in from where C was, and then sees B and then A, or A and then C, or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can think about this. The idea here is just to try to design a scenario where you got these three observers seeing three completely different things as far as simultaneity goes, and nobody is violating the laws of causality in space-time. Okay. All right, any other questions? You came in late. I was just telling him he had a question about the archive and where that is. So that's the URLs for the archive. And the other stuff was about different things you can read. Okay. This is all... Okay. This book. All right. So if there's nothing else, I guess I'll see you guys next Tuesday.